From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Strong nationalist states took hold in many Middle Eastern countries during the 20th century. Now, that model is under threat in places like Syria, Iraq, and Libya. One notable exception is Lebanon, a country with a weak state and legally recognized ethnic and religious diversity.
We are in a better place than anyone else because everybody in the region is dismantling that model.
And I'll talk with Joshua Landis about the meeting between President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the possible end of the two-state solution.
There are about 2.5 million Palestinians that live in the West Bank. In theory, a one-state solution would give them equal rights with Jews. But that's not Netanyahu's intention.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Joshua Landis, we have to do a Middle East update. Again, thank you for being here today. So President Trump met for the first time with Prime Minister Netanyahu from Israel, and they had a joint press conference, of course, this week. Very interesting statements from Trump about not really supporting a two-state solution, or at least he says, I want to support whatever is best for the two parties. So whether it's a one-state or two-state, so basically he's rolled back decades now of U.S. policy about the two-state preference. And even President Bush was strongly in favor of a two-state solution in Israel. So what are the implications of this? What are we to expect here?
Well, that's true. We've seen the U.S. now back away from the two-state solution. But even on the level of body language, this meeting was so different from the Obama administration. Obama-Netanyahu relations were so tense. They were always grim and a little bit, one would get a little anxious before watching the two together because they clearly didn't like each other. This is very different. Netanyahu was laughing throughout most of this. There would seem to be a real friendship being established between these two leaders that are very similar in many ways. So, and then Trump was very soft on Netanyahu. He said his two major statements, which is, I'm looking at the two-state and one-state solutions, and I just want what's best for everybody there. And this is explosive because since 91, America has been for a two-state solution. But since 1967 and the 67 war, when Israel conquered East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, Golan Heights from Syria, the United States has said land for peace. That was the basis for establishing peace with the Arabs and Israel. And now that seems to be really jettisoned. Israel can keep this land was the underlying statement by Trump, and that the Palestinians will have to find some kind of accommodation within an Israeli-ruled Palestinian territory.
Well, I mean, the big issue here when you say land for peace, I mean, at the crux of this situation is the settlements and the fact that Israel is expanding its settlements in the West Bank. And so it even though President Trump said, and it was interesting, he said flat out in his press conference with Netanyahu, I'd like for you to hold off on settlements. I mean, those are even the kind of statements you never even really hear a president make directly to a prime minister. But he said, I want you to hold off on settlements until we can work things out. And so, but that's not going to be popular with
Netanyahu.
He said
that with a bit of a different tone. He said, I'd like you to hold back on settlements for a bit. He said,
but still, that's very direct. I mean, it's something that's more direct, I think, than any other president has been.
Well, Obama told him he had to stop settlements, and Netanyahu was furious. He went to Congress, and he said, "I'm not going to stop settlements. And the real problem is Iran. It's not settlements, and you are trying to hurt your friends at this time of need when we need to gang up against Iran." And Congress gave him more standing ovations. And he did an end run right around the president. So I think the president has learned from that experience. And
President Trump has learned from the experience about the settlements.
I think all people dealing with that issue have learned.
But he's using the same language. He's looking directly at Netanyahu and telling him, I want you to stop settlements, yes, for a bit, but I want you to stop settlements. I mean, it was a very direct statement. Does he not mean it?
He said for a bit, no, he doesn't expect it to really happen, I don't think. He's appointed an ambassador who's on the board of one of the biggest settlement operations. Settlements are going to go on. And I think that what politicians in Washington have learned is that they're not going to stop Israel from acquiring the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That expansion that has gone on already, there's 500,000 settlers living in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which was conquered in 1967. No Israeli Knesset is going to vote against those people and make them withdraw. They're not even going to slow them down. And so Israeli politics has been going more and more right. And I think that this is a bit like the One China policy, where Trump has said, I don't want to follow it. I'm not going to follow it. And China is strong and can push back, and he had to apologize in a sense for that and climb down. But the Palestinians are extremely weak. They cannot force America to climb down from that position or Israel. And in some ways, President Trump is just recognizing this reality that Israel is going to take that land and that America is not going to stop them.
Okay, but here at the end, Joshua, will there be a response from the Palestinians? I mean, how are they likely to respond to this? Because this is a pretty significant change in U.S. policy toward the Palestinians and the Israelis.
It's a very big change. There are about 2.5 million Palestinians that live in the West Bank. This suggests that their land is going to be taken away from them over time. They're going to live under military occupation from now to eternity. Now, in theory, a one-state solution would give them equal rights with Jews. But that's not Netanyahu's intention. And so they'll live under military rule and they'll lose property slowly. That's an explosive situation. The big question is, what do the Palestinians get out of this? And that there is no answer to.
Well, the key word there is explosive. We'll be waiting, I think, to see what happens in the situation. So thank you, Joshua, for being here, as always.
A pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gorlot. Next, I'll talk with Nadeem Shahadi. He's the director of the Fares Center for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at Tufts University. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Nadeem Shahadi directs the Fares Center for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at Tufts University. He's an expert on both Lebanon and Syria, and he has consulted several governments and international organizations. Nadeem Shahadi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you here. You're here to talk about Lebanon at the University of Oklahoma, and I really think that's such a fascinating country and part of the world, and particularly because we don't hear much about it these days. Our focus seems to really be centered on Syria, what's happening in Syria, what's happening with ISIS, of course, some in the news about Iraq. But Lebanon, which used to capture a great deal of our attention years ago, things that have happened in Beirut and elsewhere, it's kind of taken, it's off the front burner, I guess we should say, maybe on the back burner. But so bring us up to date about what's happening in Lebanon and what we should know about it today.
Well, I was in Lebanon about a month ago, and it does feel very different from the rest of the region. I think if I were to explain it in the shortest possible way, it is that Lebanon skipped the 20th century, and we are probably now ahead of the game because we skipped the 20th century. What's happening in the region is that the order that was installed in the 20th century, the order of strong sovereign states with strong armies built to fight for causes, very nationalist, homogeneous, secular, socialist, that order, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, Tunis, that order which was greatly inspired by Atatürk's model, the Turkish model of secularism and nationalism and homogeneity, that's collapsing. That's really in trouble. Lebanon failed to do that. So if you look at the literature on Lebanon throughout the 20th century, it was considered a failed state. It was considered a failed state because it failed to achieve national cohesiveness. We have a constitution which recognizes diversity rather than promotes homogeneity. So we recognize 18 different religious and ethnic groups, and they all have their own personal status law and their portion of power in parliament. And that's considered anathema to a 20th century model. And because of that, we're not very nationalist. We were seen to be more identifying with our communities rather than the nation and the sovereign state. And the state was always weak. It never provided services. We had a weak army. So we failed in that sense to achieve the 20th century model. And now we are in a better place than anyone else, because everybody in the region is dismantling that model. So if you look at what's happening in Syria, what happened in Iraq, in Libya, and other places, we are probably three steps ahead, because it's very costly to get rid of a dictatorship or a strong state, especially the institutions. And when you get rid of the institutions, you have to find an alternative. You have to find a way of living without these institutions, or finding alternative institutions. But at the same time, there is hundreds of years of interaction, of learning how to coexist, sometimes better than others, than other times.
Well, this message seems to be really ironic on the one hand, in the sense that they, as you said, kind of skipped the 20th century, but yet have been, because of that, you know, lack of development, at least in this certain way, they're, as you're suggesting, ahead of the game. But yet we do know that there are influential neighbors, or those, Iran, for example, that has played a significant role in Lebanon. We do know that there are terrorist organizations, those that are considered terrorist organizations, that are operating in Lebanon. And we also know that they have very tense and difficult relations with their neighbor, Israel. And so that raises other issues in terms of how those, if they've skipped the 20th century and they're not dealing with a lot of the problems that others in the region are, dismantling the state, as you're suggesting, so like in Syria and other Iraq and others in the region.
Well, I would even say globally.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, globally.
The 20th century state, mm-hmm, as we knew it, at least in my youth, mm-hmm, in the 70s, which provided everything for people, doesn't exist anymore. And it's being dismantled at a great cost, with lots of crises happening in Europe. Borders have less meaning. We have a crisis of borders everywhere, crisis of sovereignty, of movement of population. And these movements of population are causing a crisis now because of the 20th century model, which was established post-World War II. So, for example, UNHCR, which deals with the refugees, it's a very bureaucratic organization. It takes a very long time to register, to move, to budget, to lots of negotiations, lots of bureaucracy. If UNHCR had to deal with the movement of population that happened in the 20s, in the 30s, and in the 40s, we would still be dealing with them. They just happened before that time. And I'm not saying they happened in ideal situations, but there were hundreds of thousands of people, Greeks, Turks, people in the Balkans, as you very well know, Germans after World War II, 20 million Germans were displaced, and they somehow managed to settle before the bureaucracy came in, which would have made the arrival of 10,000 refugees in the United States a huge crisis and a huge bureaucratic process for vetting. And you have literally millions of people who moved before that system was put in place.
That's Nadeem Shahadi. He's the director of the Faris Center for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at Tufts University and an expert on the Middle East. After the break, we'll talk about how the Syrian war affects Lebanon. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is Middle East expert Nadeem Shahadi. He directs the Faris Center for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at Tufts University. He's also Associate Fellow of the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. Before the break, we were discussing why Lebanon is not suffering the same level of instability as some of its neighbors.
But I'm assuming you're not suggesting that Lebanon is somehow not suffering from the crisis in the region, or that it's doesn't have its own issues, like I was suggesting, you know, vis-a-vis its neighbors, and given the kind of external influence that it's, you know, and pressure that it faces.
No, Lebanon has huge problems in the sense that we haven't been able to elect a president for the last 5 years. We haven't been able to have parliamentary elections. There's paralysis in government institutions. There is a lot of tension because of the refugees. We have one in three people in Lebanon is a refugee, someone who is destitute, coming from neighboring countries, leaving war. And part of their leaving the country is blamed on militias from Lebanon. So Hezbollah, which is a militia, which is a kind of a state within a state in Lebanon, is a participant in the Syrian war. So some of the Syrian refugees who are fleeing their homes are fleeing because of Hezbollah intervention. And you can imagine the tension of them living in camps next to villages that are pro-Hezbollah.
And how's that ever going to be resolved? I mean, how can you manage that? I mean, I'm always asking this question, obviously, when I talk to Joshua Landis and others who focused on the Middle East, is what please tell me what the solution is to that, because that is such a complicated thing in terms of how to reconstruct one society and you know, rebuild your communities.
Well, in the case of Lebanon, we have less to reconstruct and less to rebuild. In that sense, because we've always been that way, and we found a way of living together, and we're withholding the tension. The political crisis has a positive angle in the sense that our power sharing arrangement and the constitution, which also has lots of checks and balances, makes us go into total paralysis when there's a problem, until it gets resolved. Now, of course, the system broke down twice before. It broke down in 1958, causing violence. It broke down in 1975 with the civil war. But it takes a lot of pressure for it to break down. There are mechanisms that make it go into paralysis until a compromise is reached, and the country lives on compromises. In that sense.
So
there's no rigidity or ideological framework which is so rigid that it cannot reach a compromise.
Which does seem to be very different than everywhere around
it. Yes.
But speaking of this compromise issue, I mean, obviously Lebanon has been, and Hezbollah in particular, has been significantly involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And yet there's another issue that's also kind of on the back burner, it seems, given what we've seen happen in Syria, in Iraq, and with ISIS, and all of the problems we're quite familiar with. So is that another touch point that, you know, again, is just going to be ignored?
The Palestinian question is on the back burner for a very good reason. It's on the back burner because, first of all, a lot worse is happening in Syria. And people are horrified by, even Palestinians themselves are horrified by what's happening in Syria. And it makes their situation seem manageable in a way. I'm not belittling the occupation. It's an awful system. It does a lot of harm to Palestinians and Israelis alike. It's poisoning both societies, if you like, at the root of societies. I mean, the youth, the next generation is going to be still affected by it. So it's a very serious thing. But if one looks at the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, it's a conflict of the 20th century. Young people who are revolting against dictatorships in the region are also revolting against the whole mindset of these dictators. And these dictators derived their legitimacy over two, three generations from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So the Assads, the Saddams, and the Gaddafis and the Mubaraks derived legitimacy either by making war or making peace in the name of the Palestinians. And there's been states of emergency where the constitutions have been suspended, civil rights have been suspended in the region since the 1960s because of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Or at least taking the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as an excuse, or the struggle with Israel as an excuse. So youth who are revolting against the system are also revolting against these components. This is a conflict from the past. This is what their parents were exercised about. If you were in the 1920s in Europe, recovering from World War II, from World War I, sorry, where half your friends are dead and everything has changed, the Franco-Prussian War seems very far away. It's from the last century. It's the last generation. You want to change that. It's part of the problem, not of the future. So I think it's what's happening with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is very, very interesting, and there are great opportunities to resolve it now.
What are the bright spots? I mean, it sounds like you're fairly optimistic about but what are the bright spots in this region?
I'm fairly optimistic because there is a lot more to the region than what you see in the media here. If you listen to the media here, you would think that there's only ISIS in the region. There's a lot more to the region than that. And I'm also optimistic because in times of hardship and in times of huge challenges, you do get a lot of good initiatives coming out. Sometimes hardship brings out the best in people. And I can see that happening in the region. And you don't hear enough of it in the United States.
Thank you so much, Nadeem, for reminding us of that. It's great to have you here. Appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Nadeem Shahadi. He's the director of the Fares Center for Eastern Mediterranean Studies at Tufts University. You can find more information online at kgou.org and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Sam Dupre produced the show, and Jacob McClellan edited this interview. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.